Welcome back to the Fifth Estate podcast from the Wheeler Centre. In this week's episode, former minister, lawyer and World Vision CEO Tim Costello joins our host, Sally Warhaft, for a deep and wide-ranging conversation about nationalism, religion, existential pessimism and the state of the world.
It is a complete thrill tonight to have Tim Costello joining us for a one-on-one. He is, of course, an ordained Baptist minister, a lawyer, a social justice advocate, former mayor of St Kilda, former CEO of World Vision Australia, and an author of numerous books, including this latest one, which is a real gem, Tim Costello, A Lot with a Little. And Tim will be signing copies with the Hill of Content. Thank you very much at the end of this conversation. He's now still as busy as ever, but among the many things he's doing is a senior fellow at the Centre for Public Christianity. Please welcome the Reverend Tim Costello.
Thank you.
When Richmond won the 2017 Grand Final, I remember sitting there and thinking, I never have to experience this again, now that I know what it's like to win a Grand Final as a grown-up. When they won on Saturday, the siren went and I just thought, I want more. And I realised that I was becoming very greedy. So I'd like to open our conversation up tonight about what words you might have for me for dealing with this quite rotten emotion, which causes countless problems in this town and all over the world.
Well, Sally, you are asking an Essendon supporter for
comfort.
Yeah,
I know. You had your time.
I like to say Essendon, we're the only club in the AFL that took non-performance enhancing drugs. Didn't win anything, got rubbed out, still carrying a stigma for it. So yes. I don't think I'm qualified to give you comfort. But
my family are all Essendon, so I know the joy you had in the 80s.
We did. Mm. No. And every Costello, from cousins to the whole extended family's Essendon. Heresy has no rights in the Costello family. You're out if you don't barrack for Essendon. But look, I think it is interesting just the parallel between that experience of transcendence, almost sacred,
yes,
ecstatic joy, vicariously experienced really as gift. You didn't play.
No, but
you
people keep congratulating me when I wear the scarf, which I find really weird. Yeah.
You are experiencing. Yeah. You did it. So I do think it actually has some religious overtones, that whole experience.
Yeah, it really does. But the more serious, it should be the theme song if you're going to have your phone ring. Would have been delightful timing. Well, let's start with faith then, and you've mentioned transcendence, but you start in your book, very early in your book, you say, some of you will find faith's part in my story strange or perhaps overstated. Bear with me if you can, I make no sense without it. And I thought that was a beautiful introduction to that. What I found reading the book and thinking about your life and work is that your calling was just so strong. From your earliest days, it was as if you were never, ever going to be anything but following this vocation. And I wondered if you could talk a bit about that and how fortunate you are to have that.
Yeah, look, I find it puzzling when people are talking to me about their loss of direction, their lack of meaning, their sense of drifting, because you're right. I always, and I call it gift, I don't think it's my doing, the gift of having a sense that I'm called to do something, that I have a pretty broad sense of what that's about, that it hasn't wavered. There's been difficult times, but in terms of that sense of what I'm meant to be, who I am, what I'm meant to do has been strong. And look, I think faith, as soon as anyone who actually says maybe I'm more than just a biological freak in a cosmic zoo or an inanimate cell that somewhere back in an evolutionary time woke up and now have consciousness. As soon as you ask, what am I connected to that is bigger than just that material sense, immediately you're in the realm of faith. You can't prove it. There's no sense of being able to lay it down in an empirical, scientific way. But my own sense is most humans only find meaning through that faith step. There is something about my life I'm meant to do. There's something deeper that I'm connected to than just myself. Can't prove what that is. But for me, that's why faith is so foundational.
Do you remember your earliest, youngest sort of experience or feeling of it?
Yeah, in some ways it was tied up with family. I remember the sheer wonder of the nativity play outside, cold summer evening at Christmas. So it would have been 3 or 4, wrapped in my father's arms, shepherds, Mother Mary, Jesus, and just that sense of magic, security, awe. And I have had spiritual experiences since, and those strands are all there again. Security, magic, awe, transcendence. So that would be my earliest memory.
Mm-hmm. Your parents had quite different paths and understandings and expressions of their faith, and for your dad it was all about heaven, and for your mum, well, not all, but that was the strength of it for him, and for your mum it was about this world, which was an experience you described as shifting to, and I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about that shift and that turmoil of, I mean, did you feel like you had to pick between your parents?
Yeah, look, Dad was the dominant figure. I loved him so much. I respected him so much. I was at one level in fear of him so much. I think I was really late 20s, 30s before I ever individuated. I never wanted him to disapprove of me. My siblings, a brother and a sister, not just a brother, a sister also.
Three ministers too. She's ordained as well.
She's a Baptist minister. Peter was a political minister. at Dad's funeral, it was interesting, we were all really in tears, all discombobulated. He died at 97. Mm. I mean, how lucky are you, in my case, to have a father alive still when you're 60, I was 61. But that power of his integrity in his life, which came from a non-religious upbringing, a dramatic conversion, a extraordinary sense that God was real to him, really shaped the whole family script. Now, Mum, she liked to go to the theatre, to read literature. She studied Freud and became a Freudian analyst. Mum's sense of faith, she had a Christian faith, was, what's the point of just trying to escape this world and have more pure spiritual experiences to get to heaven? Better to climb back down the ladder and bring heaven on earth. So when I was young and would bring home kids from the orphanage, kids in our school, Blackie Primary, when I would bring home what Mum called strays. She said, Tim always brings home strays. She always had enough food, a whole lot of warmth, a whole lot of hospitality. Dad was warm, but Dad was very spiritually focused. So between these bookends of a different take on faith, I think my own spiritual formation was sort of oscillating. For me, Dad was the one who knew the Bible, knew the truth, lectured in New Testament Greek. But once I individuated, I realised that Mum, who didn't have as good a knowledge of the Bible, and actually Mum's theology was better. Mum actually understood that if it's not about God here and now, where the hell is God? And how are we going to make sense of it? So I describe in the book this journey for me more toward what was Mum's practical outworking of faith.
Mm. You have experienced so many subcultures of Christianity in Australia, really, like you describe really beautifully moving from the leafy green eastern suburbs, very white, very straightforward of your youth, to moving to the little Baptist church in St Kilda, and suddenly the issues were very different, and what you'd considered sin and what you'd things that you'd just not really thought about were present. Then moving to Collins Street Baptist Church, different culture again, world vision, all the work that you've done. I wonder how you think within that the broader Australian culture of how Christianity is seen in Australia, how that's changed in your life and where it is now, which is interesting and perhaps troubling for you.
Yeah, the 1950s and 60s, when I grew up, I was born in 55, were the highest decades of church attendance in Australian history. So the leafy Blackburn suburb was literally the Bible Belt. Blackburn was the buckle of the Bible Belt. You had the biggest churches, huge youth groups, and that 50s, 60s culture, probably post-war anxiety, just wanting to believe, to say there isn't the madness of war. They were very religious times. Billy Graham coming, 143,000 people at the MCG, Billy Graham preaching to, and that quite extraordinary time for Christianity. What we've seen is a fragmentation of that. It's due to institutional abuse and terrible breaches of trust. I don't know how the church who followed Jesus when he said, anyone who hurts a little child, better a millstone around his neck than you harm a child. Here, we actually completely trash what the CEO of the faith had taught. So that sense with migration of Buddhism and Islam and other faiths coming in, that sense that with secularisation, well, doesn't make a lot of sense. Carl Sandilands has just said that in a crude way over the last few days. But that drift, I think, has been real. But I do think that Australians are still profoundly spiritual. I think religion, which looks like it's an institutional set of doctrines, doesn't make sense to a lot of them. But when you actually talk about grace, fear, how faith is an antidote to fear and anxiety, I think the signature of our age is anxiety. Everyone's just so anxious. And secularism without the resources of faith, I don't think has a lot to say to that anxiety. So I actually think there is a longing and a resurgence in all sorts of fragmented kaleidoscope rainbow ways of spirituality going on. And I certainly welcome that.
Mm. It's a positive take on it. I mean, I don't know if I see that so much. I see a sort of distancing of the sacred, I suppose, in Australian life, and a distancing of community too. And I think the two are probably connected. With responses to the institutional abuse for Catholics, when you think about the, you know, the debate about the confessional, for example, where do you sit on that?
Well, I was on John Fain's Conversation Hour when the Catholic Archbishop was asked, would you break the seal of confession?
Right.
So immediately I was asked, and I said, from my understanding of Bible and faith, we are called to confess our sins to one another. There isn't a sacred priestly role which alone you confess to. So I thought and said on that program, with the Catholic Archbishop sitting there, that children's rights trumps absolutely everything. And therefore, if the law is you must report. I would say Jesus is very clear. He said the kingdom of God, the reign of God belongs to these little children. Unless you become a child, you cannot understand spiritual issues. So for me, I stand very clearly in saying you can't claim a religious sacrament that's higher than the law protecting kids.
It's interesting how rare... you've just made me think about this, both from reading and talking about how little Jesus is referred to in the conversations about this, because you also mentioned it in relation to, you know, you said Australian Christians need to calm down and suck it up like Jesus in response to debate about protection against religious discrimination, that Jesus just would never have asked for that kind of protection. And if you want to see persecution... let me take you to Afghanistan or Syria or Pakistan. Mm. It's amazing how often he's left out of it, actually.
It is. And look, I do think that I have a responsibility to speak to my mob. I think there are secular people who should speak to their mob. I am worried that social media has got us to the point of just yelling at each other. And in social media, like a giant washing machine, it sorts us into groups. Mm. And in that group of like-minded people, religious people I see do this, Christians, in that echo chamber, they whip themselves up into a frenzy that they're victims, that they're persecuted, that the secular, hostile, secular and others do it also. It's amazing to me that when you get a person out of their like-minded group where they have to sit with someone and hear their story, how quickly they'll move to compromise and acceptance. Mm. And so I felt in saying, suck it up, calm down to Christians, it was a responsibility I, as a somewhat a leader in that with that mob, needed to say.
Mm. Not really somewhat a leader, are you, I think. The other great script in your life has been your family, excuse me, script, and... you say that, you know, your father taught me restraint, and you write not a great deal about your siblings, particularly Peter, but what you write is so interesting, and I do want to talk about it a little bit. And you start off by saying that sibling rivalry is a recurring theme in the Bible, Cain and Abel, Isaac and Ishmael, and the unrelenting conflict between Arabs and Jews is also a family conflict. And you're very open about the your keenness, and I didn't realise how close you came to getting into politics, that you went to Canberra, sat down with Cheryl Curnow and Sid Spindler, and they offered you his seat. I'd forgotten, I think. It was quite a long time ago. And I felt reading this that this is my reading, that this is actually something you really wanted to do, and you were stopped by your brother and your parents, and you didn't pursue it because you're a man who eschews conflict.
Hmm. I think there's truth in that, Sally. Guilty. look, the extra layer was that neither did my wife want me to do it.
Okay. and, you don't say that.
Well, I hinted it. she had unease about it for good reasons. Her reasons were it would have been a site of conflict in the family. It would have been the first time you'd had brothers in the same parliament, in different parties, in Australian political history. And when the Australian broke it before I'd made up my mind, big Peter Costello, big brothers watching you, there was family meltdown. And it was terribly distressing to my parents and to Peter because I was still deciding. I'd been mayor of St Kilda. I thought, yep, I can do this. Cheryl Curnow and Sid Spinner had come to St Kilda Town Hall and offered me the position, casual vacancy, straight in. I thought, yeah, I'm up for this. And then before I decided, the leak in the Australian, the family meltdown, a whole range of other things convinced me that you can stretch the elastic so far, but it can snap. And in terms of family relationships, care for parents, maybe escaping, you know, the two brothers story, which has been pretty dominant in mine and Peter's life, this would have been a killer of relationships. Mm. So, but I paid tribute to my wife. She said to me, I'm not convinced about this. So she also was putting the brakes on.
It's interesting that that was the family reaction. I mean, it's I would have pointed them to football, actually, as a stage, a competitive stage where plenty of brothers have played on different teams, and that it was interesting that it was something in the sort of frame of your family that it just wasn't even possible to have a different take on it, where the matriarch could perhaps just say, well, you're going to be on different sides. We love you both. We wish you both the best. Always be respectful and enjoy. But
yeah, look, mums go and watch their sons play AFL against each other. We certainly see that. I think politics is slightly more visceral, tribal.
Maybe you would have brought something necessary to it.
Yes. Look, to be honest, it's a great question. I look back and go, what if? You know, the Democrats ended up exploding and I go, you know, maybe there might have been a centrist possibility. I always say, and I think I say in the book, don't go right, don't go left, go deeper. And that's how I've tried to live my life. On gambling, I'm seen as right wing. On refugees, climate change, I'm seen as left wing. I say to people, I don't care what you call it, left or right. This is actually heartfelt conviction. That's what I may have brought to politics, but at the end of the day, the sense that this is just too difficult for the family was persuasive.
Mm. Well, I don't know, can't say, I couldn't say whether I regret it or not, because you wouldn't have done all the wonderful other things that you did. But I think Australian politics is wanting for the kind of things that are important to you to be brought to it. And it would have been an interesting time too with the relationship between politics and Christianity as well. You got to know Kevin Rudd. That caused another dispute in the family, of course, when you were outed for supporting his policies on poverty. But I loved the line that you said, I admire prime ministers who read widely.
I do. I think I tell the story tongue-in-cheek. Kevin Rudd and I are at the Boxing Day test. Peter Settle's running into bowl and Kevin, who's prime minister, turns to me and says, Tim, do you think the Apostle Paul was a Neoplatonist? And I looked at him and said, what? But I admire prime ministers that read.
Yeah, well, he certainly does. What do you feel about the state of the world?
Right now, there's a wonderful book by Hans Rosling, Factfulness, which is worth reading. It's a book that actually says, on every measure, we have made wonderful progress and we should have hope. And he's a global health specialist, so whether it's on vaccinations and kids in poverty and just about every issue, crime, plane crashes, we are doing really well. The outlier is climate change. He admits this is the runaway train where we're not doing well. Going deeper, I'm troubled, and I write about this in the book, saying that the world's profoundly re-tribalising. Its sense of fear of the other, maybe its backlash to globalisation, retreats into the tribe that's my ethnicity, or could be sexuality, religion, nationality, and denies almost the common humanity of others because we fear them. And that old gods I call in the book, the gods of blood that lead to racism, the gods of soil that lead to nationalism. So there is Donald Trump standing at the UN just last week saying the world doesn't belong to globalists, it belongs to patriots. Well, what he really means is nationalists. Patriotism is absolutely wonderful. You know, I'm an Australian patriot. I love this country. I sat up and watched the Ashes and I was thrilled we won without having to use sandpaper. So I'm a patriot. A nationalist, by contrast, is one who says, and our way of life is the best and it should be first and it's the greatest. A patriot doesn't want to impose their way of life on others. I was at the G20 in Hamburg. I was leading what's called civil society, the C20, an outreach group. And there was Xi Jinping, China first, overcoming humiliation. There was Erdogan, Turkey first, overcoming the humiliation of the Ottoman Empire, really. There was Putin, Mother Russia's back, overcoming the humiliation of the Soviet Union. There was a man with a bad haircut saying, let's make America great again. What really hit me was, because we're in Hamburg, you'd never hear a German chancellor say, let's make Germany great again. They would know whose voice they were hearing. And that this hyper-nationalism... Now, apart from anything else, all our problems that we have to face that are global, refugees, terror, climate change, which is the big one, we cannot deal with nationalism. We actually have to find a way to trust, to work together, to mutually sacrifice. So right at the moment, we're at a roadblock and I'm feeling a bit pessimistic.
American brand of it too troubled you from your very first visit, and you were on a road trip arguing with your father about all sorts of things. But you had a really strong reaction to what you describe as the jingoism baptized as Christian triumphalism, where American flags were hung in churches next to the cross and their God seemed to be American and on the side of the winners. So it's obviously something that you've always sort of identified. You also talk about living in Europe in the 80s and meeting couples who were so pessimistic about the Cold War that they decided not to have children. Mm. We're now starting to hear this from young people about climate change as well. It's bleak, isn't it?
Yeah, we were studying in Zurich from 1980 to 84, and the Germans... West Germans knew that most of NATO's missiles were on West German soil, and the East Germans, who were also studying and come out, knew that Warsaw Pact missiles were on East German soil, both homing in on each other. And our contemporaries were 26, 27 when my wife and I started there, were consciously saying, we won't have children. It's irresponsible. It's going to blow up. And we, coming from Australia where, you know, there might be a mushroom cloud somewhere, but we're rubbing on the suntan oil and saying she'll be right, were quite struck by just that existential level of pessimism. It went deep. It really, really hit us. Absolutely. Now with climate change, we're seeing that. I noticed that our Prime Minister and others think it's just... anxiety of young people, and they should feel safe, and the responses to Greta Thunberg. But, you know, our Prime Minister was at the Pacific Island Forum, and there was the Prime Minister of Tuvalu, an adult, in tears. So it's not just children anxious and in tears. There's David Attenborough, 90, is he? Mm-hmm. Anxious and saying, we're going the wrong way, we have to have action. So I think the faux pastoral care, we're worried about Greta and we're worried about young people. Actually, this is serious. This is really serious.
Mm. And in Australia, I mean, I get the feeling you're rather disappointed in our current leadership on various fronts, climate change first and foremost, but also as givers, particularly internationally, that what underlies this is a sense that Australians just don't understand how lucky we are. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, no, I think we've profoundly lost perspective. When you lose perspective, you become ungrateful. I think gratitude is so fundamental for living life well. The gift of today. I think we compare up, never compare down. And when we compare up, someone's always doing better. If we compare down, we feel grateful. We go, aren't I blessed? I say in the book that we've confused the cost of living, yep, rising and tough, with the cost of a lifestyle. So that now we regard it as a fundamental human right to have a annual holiday in Bali or go to Europe, whereas when I was growing up, a holiday at Rosebud, we were just as happy. We were thrilled. So when it comes to levels of aid, which has been an ongoing issue throughout my adult life, I am troubled that aid was at its highest under Bob Menzies, 0.5% of gross national income. And Menzies said some wonderful, generous things about the poor and why we in Australia will be there for them and gave. We now have aid at its lowest level ever, 0.21%. And the Abbott hockey budget was where it was at, utterly smashed. 20% of the budget savings for Abbott and hockey came from the poorest people and it cost lives. And I just find this appalling when Credit Suisse brought out an index, I think it was 2 months ago, saying the highest per capita wealth in the world is now Australia. So here we are in one of the richest times in history with the highest per capita wealth. Yep, we have homelessness. We have a whole lot of issues I've spent a bit of my life working on. I don't dismiss those. But we are so mean. When did we become this cruel? When I went to Manus and saw Barus, who won the Premier's Prize, when I met with people who really were undergoing psychological torture. There's no other word. Just the sheer cruelty of them living with total uncertainty, I thought, when did we become this cruel? How did this happen? When a Tamil family can't be accepted to stay here because it might, compassion might create a precedent. Like, we outlaw compassion because there's some precedent. This is quite bizarre to me, so I must admit, disappointed on a number of fronts with our leaders.
So when do you think it happened? Because it's not, I mean, leaders, you know, they legislate things, but most often because they can. You know, we're, as a society, Australia's really gone with the flow on that. I've never seen marches, protesting our lack of generosity. Was there a moment?
Yeah, I personally think that 15 years ago with the Tampa, something changed. I personally think it damaged the Aussie soul. So the message of fear and the othering of those people rather than their humanity, common humanity, reinforced this Australian tribal sense, not our problem. Once that was burnt into our soul, and it's continued with ludicrous messages, I mean, as if we all don't know. The boats are always trying to smuggle something into Australia. If it's not people, it's drugs. If it's not drugs, it's weapons. Peter Dutton, when I met him after coming back from Manus, admitted this to me. So this notion that somehow if we were generous to the people in Manus and Nauru settling them here or in New Zealand, all the boats would start again. It's complete nonsense. Everyone knows it's complete nonsense, but it now is so burnt into our psyche as Australians, this tribal psyche of Fortress Australia, that has damaged our soul. And I think that's overflown into giving. If I had a dollar for every person who stops me and says, Tim, forget those people overseas, charity begins at home. Well, I spent 20 years working in domestic charity here with homeless and drug affected. And when I question people who say that to me, I discover they're usually people doing the least about charity at home. There is a harshness and a leave pass going on here.
Well, I mean, giving is something that's... I mean, you were raised on it, weren't you? Your father always gave away a percentage of a very modest income. But how can you... Well, can you turn that around?
So I look to the next generation. This is where I have great hope with the Greta Thunbergs and the millennials or Z or whatever they're now called. I think, you know, my dear old mum, who's 90, she said a couple of things to me. One, when she read my book, she said, I hadn't realised, Tim, how much your father is still in your head. That was really interesting.
Wow.
The second thing, and I think it was at the time Barnaby Joyce was having a few marital difficulties. And my 90-year-old mum said, you know, Tim, once it was the older people that taught values and virtues to the next generation, I actually now think it's reversed. The young people have to teach us values and morals. And I thought Greta Thunberg and some of those are pioneering that. So I do have some hope that their sense of connectedness to the world and... without the possibility probably of ever owning a house, they're going to, so we can make a difference. We have agency is encouraging.
Yeah, it is. It is, although I sort of think too that if that is the answer, and it would be my answer too, you know, yeah, we're going to leave it up to the youngsters that it's the capacity to do it might not be there by the time they get the reins, but... what else did your mum say about the book? It's fascinating.
she was really pleased because, how do you describe this? She loved my father, but she was always frustrated that he was totally unambitious.
Hmm.
He never took promotions. He only wanted to be a teacher in the classroom. He didn't believe in eating out or going to the theatre. He liked the footy and the... fish and chips and the newspaper was eating out for Dad. And I think she lived, as many women did, with that frustration that there are better things, they are of this world, they're not extravagant, whereas Dad was very spiritual and otherworldly. So I think telling her story gave her quite a sense of, yeah, that's, thank you. Thank you for saying that. That was difficult for me. But look, she had graduated university, she taught, she had her own career. But life, you know, life for bright women like her in the burbs in Blackburn wasn't always easy.
Mm. Although, you know, this title, A Lot With A Little, I would have actually, if I'd been your editor, I would have said A Lot With A Lot.
Thank you.
Mm.
So the title comes from Mum. Dad and Mum met at university and Dad was tested by Mum for his IQ. She was a psych student. And he was by far the brightest student she tested. So she said, I'm keeping my eye on him. Difficult romance because she was in hospital for nearly 2 years, told she was going to die, told when my dad and her got engaged, you mustn't marry, it'll kill you. They said, we're getting married, told you mustn't have kids. When I was conceived, advised to terminate. And I met a wonderful nurse who's also in her 90s down in Hobart, Jane, who said to me, I was there. I remember Tim, the doctor said, we advise you terminate. I remember your mum's very words. She said, oh, fiddlesticks, what would they know? And my dad took great pleasure reading the obituary notices to see that the doctor that gave Mum that advice had died. But the title, after Dad died, Mum took me aside and she said, you know, your father was near genius. He was the brightest man I knew. I tested him way back then and married him. But, Tim, you'd have to say your father did a little with a lot. You and I, Tim, we've done a lot with a little.
See, that's why your editor said go with it. And I'm no longer an editor. But you did have a lot, you know. I mean, the trials of your life, it seems to me, of your life, not, you know, obviously the terrible struggles of, you know, going to war zones and terrible places of tragedy, but has been mostly a spiritual struggle. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. It's that sense that all humans carry the image of God. They are as loved by God, of course, their parents, as I love my children. Therefore, they should have the rights and the breaks and the chance. And most of the work, you know, we think of development work as the hardware, the clinic, health, school, it's the well. Actually, it's more the software. It's being there and saying, particularly in a disaster, you're not alone. I know your name. I look into your eyes. You're not abandoned. Because I think most humans deep down have this sense, do I matter? Do I actually matter? And in disaster, when it's like the world looks away, no one cares, being there and saying you matter is actually the spiritual side of the work.
Describe how you felt when you started travelling for World Vision and going to these sites, and how it changed your feelings about being a human in this world.
Yeah, I had always been a sunny optimist. I believed, you know, you can get in, you can make a difference, you can bring a bit of heaven on earth. The tsunami, well, my first disaster was Darfur, and the number of women, black Sudanese Dinka Noor women raped by the Arab Janjaweed, just overwhelmed me. I ended up doing a press conference back here in Australia and just breaking down and crying. So here was, you know, my first disaster, and I couldn't actually even quite communicate, other than tears, what it's like to look into the face of evil, that humans can be so malevolent, so malevolent. The tsunami, which was the next disaster, which was massive, mass graves, women and children, they couldn't run or climb a tree like men, so that's who died. The smell of corpses in mass graves, the apocalyptic sense of silence, people just staring out to sea, hoping that a loved one's body might be washed up or they might still be alive, and just eerie silence. It changed that sunny optimism to say there are things that are overwhelming and arbitrary and tragic. But the other side of it, and this sounds a bit macabre to say, I kept going to disasters. I've gone to them all in the last 15 and a half years. And apart from that spiritual presence, help, I would say from a personal point of view, I never felt more alive than when I was in those situations. Macabre, because you say there's tragedy and brokenness, but that sense that you are privileged to be where it's rawest, to offer something that is of help, that you come back and you have the responsibility to tell the story. I probably live with a bit of PTSD. I can be at a happy occasion giving a speech unrelated to any work in relief. I'll get an image in my head of someone I've seen. Without warning, I'll just be in tears. And people will look at me and go, that's odd. what's he crying for? And you actually realise that you live, you can build walls around your emotions, but they still leak. And when they leak, there's never really warning. And part of it is that you do carry a guilt that I was their hope to tell their story, to raise some money, to give them a chance. Did I do it adequately? And that is heavy. But going and being there, I really, really did feel very alive, that this was what I was meant to do.
What about the development industry do we just fail to comprehend that you most would like everyone to just understand?
The development is what our politicians are on about here. It's usually more growth. Like, the disconnect for me is I didn't wake up this morning, roll out of bed and say to myself, great, another day. What can I add to the GDP today? and at the end of the day, ask what the measure is. But that's what development is. It's this sense that countries can grow, they can actually have better services, people can fulfil their potential. What is really important for me in development is that with the history of might be slavery, colonialism, it might be just that you're a landlocked country without natural resources, with even nasty neighbours, that aid with trade can give that country a chance. It means girls getting to go to school. It means vaccinations, which we've been remarkably successful in, so that when I started at World Vision, it was 30,000 kids under the age of 5 that died every day of stupid poverty. Dirty water, preventable disease, not getting enough calories. Today, it's under 15,000 kids under the age of 5 that will die. Far too many still, but this is what development is. It's keeping kids alive under the age of 5. When you keep them alive, getting them an education. When they get an education, having policies and an economy that gets them a job. Development is no different here in Australia as it is for where we work, World Vision works and other NGOs work. So for me, it's the same human drive. And if we can play a part helping it with our generosity, with our giving and serving, we should.
It's a great definition. Keep a child alive, educate them, get them a job. And 5 is a magic number, isn't it? You've got to get them through those early years. It must have been an amazing experience to go from your Baptist church to, a staff of, 600 and $400 million budget. And was that part of it your cup of tea?
No, I was a terrible manager. I say in the book the first day, it might have been the second day, being CEO at World Vision, my wife wakes me up, time to go to work. I pull the doona back over my head. She says, come on, get off to work. And I said, I don't want to be a CEO. You go. The number of things you sign, the full responsibility for those staff. You know, in curious ways, you'd be putting out as CEO an OHS warning as you walk up the stairs at World Vision, remember to hold the guardrail, and an hour later be sending your staff into Afghanistan and Syria and Pakistan, where we lost staff who died. Mm. So you were having to manage... and I think I was quite good at getting a good executive team to do that. I think where my gifts lay were vision casting, keeping up morale, reminding ourselves in the really hard times that we're not alone, we can't give up on the world. In my faith, God hasn't given up on this world, so we can't. I think that's where more the leadership was.
Mm. What about governance? What makes it good?
So the World Vision has a board. It has people who have great governance skills on that board, the former CEO of Medibank at the moment, the former New South Wales Police Commissioner who oversaw the Lindt Cafe has joined the board. You have a number of people who have good governance roles, and their job is really to ask you as a CEO what really is going on, where you need support, where they hold you accountable. So board meetings, five a year, they're a bit like exams, really. You had to be across, you know, a $400 million budget and how HR and morale and recruitment was going. So they were onerous.
Do the principles, though, of good governance apply sort of everywhere for an organisation like World Vision, a government, businesses, sporting groups? Are they the same? What are the bigger principles, you think?
Yeah, they're the principles of transparency, accountability, that you've actually done what you said you were going to do. Look, I think for not-for-profits, particularly international NGOs, they're tougher. Mm. They're tougher because everyone has to pay tax, and we're upset if a bit's wasted, but, you know, we can drop $50 billion on some submarines in Adelaide and try and say we're going to be the 10th largest arms exporter in the world, only to find out this week we're the second biggest arms importer in the world. That really worked. But we sort of give a leave pass until an election time with government. Business, as long as you share your dividends being returned. Where it's different is people have sacrificially given to an aid agency and they are often saying to themselves, is my money doing what they promised? So I was the first of any NGOs to introduce what we called an annual effectiveness review. And in it, we published not just stories of our success, but stories of our failure, where we'd taken money, we'd said this is going to work, and it hadn't. Now, the marketers at World Vision just hated me for doing this. They said, tell them every dollar made it and works. And I said, well, where in life is that true? It's not true anywhere in life. Mm. We won Pricewaterhouse Transparency Awards for doing this.
But the obsession with overheads, with aid, it's weird.
So we in the aid sector have hoisted ourselves on a ridiculous petard. We have hoisted ourselves that the best program is the one that has the lowest overheads. Now, if my wife, I think she's here tonight, was ill and I needed a doctor, would I start ringing around medical clinics and as my first question ask, what are the overheads of this medical clinic? And then choose the medical clinic with the lowest overheads. Or would I say, my wife's got these symptoms, what's the medical clinic's historical record in treating these symptoms? I don't care what the overheads are. In other words, effectiveness is almost more important than efficiency. Now, World Vision in my time was very good on low overheads. So it was 20 cents in the dollar was marketing and overheads, 80 cents, getting there. But that question of I'm just going to give it to the lowest overheads really is self-defeating in terms of good development work.
Mm. And when you travelled so much and you had a principle of going everywhere where there was a something going on, was there a place that you unexpectedly connected to?
Myanmar.
Right.
I was there a number of times, a number of disasters. 160,000 died with a cyclone. The patient suffering of these gentle people under malevolent regimes just blew me away. Their courtesy, their sense of hope against hope. This is when Aung San Suu Kyi was still locked up. I particularly connected to the Burmese, particularly the Karen and some of the tribal groups. So lots of other places I did, but certainly Myanmar.
Mm, mm. And your wife, of course, who I'm not sure where, Merity?
Merity,
is sitting, but 40 years
Married.
And a great line, how grateful I am for the wife of my youth.
Mm.
I thought that was the most beautiful way to describe a long marriage and, you know, in a day and age where there are not as many of them that you yes. come across, particularly at my age.
I bought her an eternity ring and for the 40th anniversary. I presented it. We're leading a group in Turkey and Greece in May at our wedding anniversary. I presented it on one knee to her, made a speech. I saw all the other guys, the women actually going like that. And the men came up to me afterwards and said, "You bastard."
Well, if you've got it, flaunt it, I think. And, you know, what a journey you've had together. I mean, the days, particularly in Europe, just when you were just starting your family in the early days of your marriage, just sound like a wonderful experience. And I really recommend this memoir. I get a lot of these memoirs, a lot of memoirs, and I'm a bit anti-memoir. I just sort of feel like everybody thinks their story is interesting and that they have a capacity to tell it well, and it's very few people who have both of those things. But this one's really, really good. It's, you say in the beginning, you know, all memoirs are a deceit to some extent, and... you know, that we leave things out. And I sort of read that and I thought, oh, gosh, there's going to be nothing in here. but it's very full. It really, I really, really loved it. So whatever else you're planning on getting up to in the next decades, we will all look forward to and hope it continues to be out where we can all observe it, at least from a little bit of a distance. It's been a wonderful contribution you've made so far. Thanks for coming along. Thanks for everything you've done. And thank you all too for coming tonight to hear Tim Costello.
Sally Warhaft and Tim Costello. Recorded live on Tuesday, the 1st of October 2019 at the Wheeler Centre, Melbourne's home for conversations about books, writing and ideas. Check us out at wheelercentre.com. And until next time, take care.